Just present. So welcome back to our next plenary session. This is a new format that we are implementing today with shorter presentations on higher yield topics. And we named this format the President and His Friends. So our president this time is Dr. Fred Mader. He's the president of OLTCC. He's the medical director of Sunnyside Home at Region of Waterloo. His current activities include representing OLTCC at the Long-Term Care Public Inquiry. He believes that OLTCC is the physician's voice to the public, government, and stakeholders in long-term care. In order of seating, our first guest is Joanne Ho. Joanne Ho is an internist. Dr. Ho is an internist, geriatrician, and clinical pharmacologist. She's currently an examiner with the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Medicine, Division of Geriatric Medicine at McMaster University, Waterloo Regional Campus. She has started GeriMedRisk, a geriatric clinical pharmacology and psychiatry consultation service in Ontario. Our next guest is Dr. Nathan Herman. Dr. Herman is the Richard Lewis Chair in Geriatric Psychiatry at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center and at the University of Toronto. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto. He's head of the Division of Geriatric Psychiatry at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center. He's co-director of the Clinical Neuropharmacology Laboratory and scientist in the Hurwitz Brain Sciences Research Program and the Center for Stroke Recovery. Last but not least, our guest is Dr. Paul Katz. Dr. Katz is currently the chair of the Department of Geriatrics at the College of Medicine at Florida State University. Dr. Katz previously served as vice president of medical services at Baycrest Health Center in Toronto. His research has focused on the role of the physician or physicians in the post-acute and long-term care setting. So I will pass now the microphone to our president, Dr. Mader.
So the challenge for all of us here in the front is to stay within our time limits here, and I think this could almost be viewed as a trailer for some of the topics that we'll be talking about at our next conference, which will be a year from now. I want to briefly bring you up to date about the long-term care inquiry, often referred to as the Wetlaufer inquiry. The Ontario long-term care clinicians were participants in the inquiry. There were about 17, 18 groups that were participants, and it was a real privilege for OLTCP to be accepted, OLTCC to be accepted as a participant. And I just wanted to give you a quick overview. There were some questions raised yesterday, which I will answer in a few slides. This is a very detailed slide, but I will just point out a couple of things in the slide here to give you an overview of the events that led to the long-term care inquiry. That red line goes from the death of Mr. James Silcox in December 2007 to the death of Arpad Horvath in August 2014. All of those people were killed with overdoses of insulin by the nurse Elizabeth Wetlaufer. Her last victim was an attempted murder, and that's the circle up there in the upper right-hand corner, Beverly Bertram, who was a home patient. At that time, Wetlaufer was working for a home care agency, and she was given an overdose of insulin but survived the episode of severe hypoglycemia. The purple line is represents the length of time that Elizabeth Wetlaufer worked at Crescent Care Long-Term Care in Woodstock. She was let go just shortly after the death of Maureen Pickering, who was the seventh death. And then just before she was hired at Meadow Park Lodge in London, where she killed her final victim, Arpad Horvath. So those are the murders, and there's two episodes of aggravated assault and attempted murder, and two of attempted murder before and two afterwards. In the third week of September was the closing submissions, and the first couple of days were the victim impact statements by the families of the victims. But there was one victim that actually spoke for herself, and that was Beverly Bertram. And it was a very moving thing to observe, because she asked the public hearings at that time, what was it about this person that allowed her to kill such vulnerable people over a period of time? And that's what the inquiry was all about. This is from an article Heather Malik had in the Toronto Star in June, when the public hearings first opened up. And I liked it because I think it really looked at who was having the finger pointed to them during the public hearings, and it indeed turned out to be the case. There was the question about what was the role of the ONA, the Ontario Nurses Association, who was the union representing Elizabeth Wetlaufer, and I'll show you where they came under suspect. There's the CNO, the College of Nurses of Ontario. There had been complaints filed, and her record wasn't part of the public information, but the CNO, like the CPSO, have all learned from this and are making changes. Of course, the home had been inspected, and there had been critical incidents complaints that had been filed with respect to this nurse, but it did not identify the lethality of her practice. Her employers, they kept her on staff for years, but it was because it was a home that had a problem getting nursing staff, and often Wetlaufer was working the night shift, and there was a requirement that the home, like all of our homes, have a RN on duty 24/7, and there were very few choices for them otherwise. And then there was the pastor, and there were indeed other people that she had actually confessed to, told them what they were doing, and no one really believed her, and she could have been identified a lot sooner. So people asked me about the doctors who were at the inquiry, and it was a very difficult time, and I couldn't help but say to myself, there but for the grace of God goes I, because any one of us could be in an uncomfortable position like this, and it just shows how we communicate and how we document our care is so important. Dr. McDonald was the doctor at Meadow Park in London, who hadn't worked with her that long, but had interestingly sent an email to the director of care saying he had some concerns about this nurse, which makes me think that, well, maybe doctors should be more forthcoming if they have concerns. Dr. Richard Reddick in the center up there was the attending physician at Woodstock. Dr. Dirk Hoor, some of you would indeed know, he's the chief coroner of Ontario. Rick Mann from London was the regional coroner involved. And William George and Elizabeth Urbacki were also coroners involved in two or three of the deaths. It was a difficult week in July when the coroners had to explain their roles in deaths in long-term care. This is one of the very damning pieces of evidence, and it was written by the human resources person at Crescent Care in Woodstock. That's where their head office is, too. And it was Elizabeth Wetlaufer's letter of recommendation after she had murdered the seventh person and had been terminated for drug errors after that point. It was a negotiated letter with the ONA, so there would not be a grievance filed. And I highlight the third paragraph. During her time with us, Ms. Wetlaufer proved herself a good problem solver with strong communication skills, who was punctual and enjoyed sharing her knowledge with others. And there was very little in the evidence presented to support that that was the case, but that was part of a settlement that included a $2,000 payout. Now, one thing I don't think that was recognized is the current review of deaths in long-term care. And I did point out when one of the council asked the question to Dirk Hoer, what the role of the coroner's office was in long-term care, and I did point out off the record that we have had Dr. Roger Skinner, who chairs the long-term, the geriatric and long-term care committee, regularly speak at our conference. The other physician who was an expert testimony was Richard Polanin, who is the chief forensic officer of Ontario, and he gave his opinion. He did say that in some of the deaths, cause of death could maybe be determined by the finding of hypoglycemic encephalopathy. Although I think when we look at the erratic blood sugars of a lot of our patients, it could be a pathological finding in many cases where there's not any malfeasance. So let me conclude by saying that we have given closing submissions from the long-term care clinicians. They are available on the website. I really encourage you to visit the website, which is Long-Term Care Inquiry CA. There's a lot of documentation and exhibits there that tells us a lot about long-term care and what is done. And just to go through our recommendations, the first five are all sort of part of our advocacy plan, which I mentioned this morning. I think the two that I would highlight is that there needs to be a better internal process of death investigation with external oversight that will more readily identify population characteristics, staffing patterns, and changes in procedure or environment. And we differ from many of the other groups that gave closing submissions who there are indeed recommendations that perhaps the Office of the Coroner needs to be professionalized a bit more, but I liken it to how we manage infection control so well in our care right now, where we identify a line listing and, if necessary, proceed with isolation and public health notification to identify problems quickly based on our own data and information. And finally, because we're the group that helps to represent pharmacy as well, and I will be assisted by one of our pharmacists when I go to further consultation, that ways in which technology can improve the interdisciplinary communication and medication management. So that's a brief overview of the long-term care inquiry. The final report's coming out in July. There's still consultations and plenary sessions, and I can assure you that OLTCC will be at the table.
Thank you for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. So I heard that I have 10 minutes. Otherwise, 10 to 15. Otherwise, Fred might give me a hook. So I'm not going to present too much of the research and all the work that's actually behind this project, but it's more of just to introduce Jerry Mebrisk, which is what I've been working on for a while with an amazing team. So we are really in our mission is really integrated drug safety service and education. I really have no commercial interest to disclose any of the support that I receive or Jerry Mebrisk receives is through healthcare organizations and nonprofit organizations or through grants, all peer-reviewed. So as a geriatrician and clinical pharmacologist, this is the most common question I get asked. What drug should I avoid in my older patient? What should I never prescribe? And usually when I kind of pose the question back to people, I go, what do you think causes the most harm in our older population. Usually people say anticholinergics or benzodiazepines or antipsychotics. Well, the interesting thing is when you look at the evidence, it's actually the common drugs that we prescribe all the time. Our antihypertensives, our diuretics, our antiplatelets, anticoagulants that we use to prevent stroke or another cardiac event. So what do we do? Do we just not prescribe at all? Maybe we just deprescribe. Lovely concept, but can be challenging sometimes. And let me just present two scenarios, two fictitious patients all inspired by real cases. So meet Susan. Susan is a 90-year-old woman who recently was admitted to your long-term care home after a very significant hemorrhagic stroke, and she is on a benzodiazepine for insomnia. She has a little bit of hypertension, osteoarthritis. However, she's still cognitively intact. She really enjoys participating in all of the activities that are there, loves the physio, enjoys her visits from family. Both you and your pharmacist and the whole team go, let's look at this benzodiazepine. You present her with the Empower pamphlet, talk about deprescribing guidelines. She says, let's go for it. This is awesome. And within weeks, she's off the benzo. Voila. Now meet George. George is a 90-year-old World War II vet who is also newly admitted to your long-term care home. He, too, also suffers from insomnia, so he's on one benzo for that, and he's been on that for many, many years, decades, he'll tell you. And also, he also has a second benzodiazepine for his anxiety attacks, which he sometimes needs twice, maybe three times a day, sometimes maybe more. He also has multiple medical comorbidities. He has atrial fibrillation. He's on warfarin, maybe some amio for that. He has heart failure with an ejection fraction of 20%, chronic kidney disease. He has multiple medications. And the thing is that people are worried. His family was worried when they saw him holding onto furniture and the wall at home. They were worried when he wasn't as sharp as he was before. They were worried when they saw other medications that he had to take. His family physician before he came into long-term care was also worried. The family physician already presented, what about counseling, CBT? Let's try melatonin. Maybe we'll try a different medication, trazodone, mirtazapine. All of those were tried, but it just didn't work. The electronic medical record that he was using was always flagging, benzo, stop this. This is a bad drug. You know, all the apps and tools were lighting up. The pharmacist was also calling, saying, look at this medication, is this really working out? But yet, it was very difficult to actually be able to take away those medications. And so, when he came into long-term care, again, the team also kind of saw this and thought, oh my goodness, in the electronic medical record, you know, the point-click care was showing, oh, look at these medications. The pharmacist was also identifying these as an issue. Again, they were trying non-pharmacologic. Perhaps let's, you know, try this, try that. But what they saw was that this is an individual who was really suffering. And they were all worried. They were suffering when they tried to take away the medications. They were really trying their best. And, of course, there are all these other medications. But this is exactly the type of patient that I really went into geriatrics and clinical pharmacology for. You see, because I see deprescribing as like a drugectomy, you need to know where and when to cut. And sometimes there's a lot of things that are quite connected. And so when I actually was in Waterloo, Wellington, and they had the opportunity, the first thing I did was I asked, how can I help? Is there something that I can do to maybe help? And there were lots of opinions. So in our needs assessment, we actually found that the clinicians that were working with seniors have many really good thoughts that were all supported by evidence already. They found that having too many prescribers, too many pharmacies, too many people involved certainly was an issue when it came to prescribing safely for their seniors. So the big take-home message is that, yes, you can help, but don't make it too complicated, okay? There's a whole team that's already involved, so please be quite, you know, integrated with the care. So I did, okay. The second thing was, yes, telemedicine is certainly an option. Certainly an option. Telephone is also very helpful, secure email or through e-consult. And some said, sure, the good old-fashioned way of having you come in, you know, we fax the request, you come in, that's okay too. But no matter what it is, just get back to us quickly. Not by weeks, not months, not when it's convenient to you, but we want it within days. So I thought, okay, what else? And they said, we want knowledge. We know that we want to have industry-free information, but we want to have access to evidence-based education. So I said, okay, no problem. Let's go for it. And with the guidance of many individuals who are also in this room, Dr. Sib Feldman is one individual that I certainly do look towards and really grateful for the feedback that he gave very early on, as well as the many other mentors that I've had in my training, including Dr. Herman, who's also on this panel as well. That's where Jerry Members came from, we provide a service and really it's an integrated consult service. Where we have geriatric pharmacy, geriatric psychiatry, geriatric medicine, and clinical pharmacology all working together. And we try to get back to people within days. But our goal is not to be an extra prescriber. Our goal is to augment the patient's existing local circle of care. So how it works is really there's the patient and their team. If they have a question, then they can call us or they can reach out to us through eConsult. And that's available on both provincial platforms, either OTN or BASE. And from there, we all get involved, whoever needs to get involved. Sometimes it's mainly the pharmacist and the geriatric psychiatrist. Sometimes they feel that it's important if, from a medicine point of view, I come in from geriatric medicine and clin pharm. And together, we provide one note that's coordinated and within 5 business days. But the education part really rang through. So we said, okay, how about consult-based education? So if with every single consult that we provide, we also provide drug information on the particular drug that we're changing, we're stopping, or that we're starting. And we know how busy everyone is. And so we've really taken upon ourselves, we have a new grant, to really revamp them, to make them more efficient and easier to learn about the drugs that we're prescribing so we can prescribe them safely for our older patients with comorbidities. So if anyone's interested in helping us evaluate that, we are recruiting for people to be able to help us make this better. Knowledge sharing is important. And so we are more than happy. We have our monthly Jerry Clin Pharm, Jerry Med rounds that are broadcast across the province during a lunchtime. So if anyone wants to just join in, maybe it's a refresher. Maybe you already know lots about that medication. Fantastic. But if you happen to pick up one extra thing, that's amazing. And then we're also evaluating that too. And we're here to help. So far, it's been a real privilege to be able to start this and become available. And we're here to help individuals from all clinical settings and all clinicians, physicians, nurse practitioners, and also pharmacists. In fact, long-term care pharmacists have been calling into us quite frequently. And we're there to support their work because we know how important it is to still have that face-to-face time. We're not going to replace humans. So if there's a way that we can use technology to support the great work that you guys are doing, then that would be absolutely fantastic. So back to George. So for that particular case, we see the consult. The coordinated consult between all three specialties actually did happen, because not only did, and so with the team, it had to all be coordinated. It wasn't just me. I couldn't do absolutely everything, nor could our pharmacist, nor could our geriatric psychiatrist. We worked together, and we provided one set of recommendations, which then was taken to the family and the patient. And they were relieved that our automatic answer wasn't going to be stop the benzo, because it was a lot more complicated than that. You know, how do we address, you know, diagnosing the fact that perhaps this individual had PTSD and all the different treatment options from there? But also, how can we optimize all the different medical conditions and all the other medications? And when you do that, what types of drug interactions are actually going to be relieved? And what do we expect? And how do you just delicately balance all those medications? That's kind of what we really enjoy doing. You know, sure enough, we were able to get back to the team within days. And the actual actions took about 2 months to actually fully take effect, because sometimes it was, if this option works, then that's great. If not, here's another option. And ultimately, there was a very, very good result. And again, this is a fictitious patient, but taken from a large number of patients that we frequently provide care to. But I do want to thank all of our partners who gave us the opportunity, as well as the many mentors that I've had to be able to develop this. And I wouldn't be here without a team. But really, that's what we hope to be, a team, an extension of your team. And our evaluation and our clinical trials wrapping up, and we have some very exciting results to present. So Thank you very much.
So Dr. Herman will be the next friend.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. I think this is the third time that I'm speaking at the OLTCC in the last decade, and it's really an honor to be here. I think you guys are the unsung heroes of the medical community in our province, and you really deserve a lot of recognition. So it is a pleasure to be here, but I'm very upset with your conference organizers because they failed to mention that this was a 10 to 15 minute talk and I've got about 40 slides. So please forgive me if you get vertigo as we rush through these slides. In terms of disclosures, I do very small numbers of, I run a clinical neuropharmacology laboratory at Sunnybrook and all I do is spend time doing clinical trials for Alzheimer's disease. So I do have a little bit of interaction with Big Pharma, actually much less than I did, say, 10 or 20 years ago. Unfortunately, as you know, a lot of the clinical trials for Alzheimer's disease have failed over the last several decades, and unfortunately, Big Pharma is becoming less and less interested. So I do much less in the way of contract trials, but a little bit of work. This presentation has not received any support from pharma, and the studies that I'm going to be talking to you about today have been funded by the Alzheimer's Society of Canada as well as the Alzheimer's Disease Discovery Foundation in the United States. So I will mitigate potential bias by talking about a genericized product today. And probably the only other important disclosure is that I have no personal experience with THC. Okay, I'm just going to skip all of these introductory slides that talk about agitation and dementia. You guys work with this every single day. You're all very familiar with it. Just the one thing I do want to talk about is the fact that if I was a non-medical colleague of yours getting up talking about agitation and aggression in Alzheimer's disease, I would be trying to convince you that it's all caused by unmet needs. And I can tell you that I've spent my career the last 30 years trying to prove that, in fact, there is a biological basis for these behaviors. And just last week in Alzheimer's and Dementia, which is the official journal of the Alzheimer's Society of the United States, we published a major review article. It's about 40 pages long on the biological correlates of agitation and aggression, the biomarkers associated with this illness. So we truly, in my lab, believe that this is a biological condition and that, therefore, it is certainly rational to try to treat it with medications. So let me just go right to the endocannabinoid system. So if you're looking for a rationale for why cannabinoids might be useful to treat Alzheimer's disease, particularly to treat agitation and aggression in Alzheimer's disease, this would be the reason. And I just want to remind you that the two most prominent ingredients in cannabis, or the two most prominent compounds, pharmacologically active compounds in cannabis, are THC and cannabidiol, or CBD. And unfortunately, they have very different effects, and sometimes they have antagonistic effects on each other. But in general, these are the kinds of things that cannabinoids might affect. And in green, I have the reason why you might think that these are useful agents to treat agitation and aggression in Alzheimer's disease. So at the level of the amygdala, they have generally anti-anxiety effects. That's both THC as well as cannabidiol, and they can decrease hostility. In the brainstem, they decrease pain, and we all know that untreated pain in Alzheimer's disease is very important because patients can't complain about it, and they sometimes become agitated and aggressive as a result of pain that we're maybe not identifying. And then finally, particularly in long-term care patients with Alzheimer's disease, losing weight and loss of appetite are very important problems, and cannabinoids increase appetite. Unfortunately, besides all these good things that the drugs might do, they also alter consciousness, they cause perceptual distortions and hallucinations and illusions, and they interfere with memory. So really, cannabinoids represent a double-edged sword in terms of their use in Alzheimer's disease. Again, I'm not going to go through the details of the clinical pharmacology. We can talk about that later if you're particularly interested in. But just to remind you that there are two major cannabinoid receptors in the brain and body, the CB1 and CB2. CB1 is generally the receptor that would have the effects that we're particularly in particularly interested in from a behavioral perspective in terms of being anti-nausea, increasing appetite drugs, as well as effects on anxiety. But they also can lead to the negative side effects such as psychotic symptoms. And CB2, though, is also very interesting because if you look down here, what you see is that they're anti-inflammatory. They reduce excitotoxicity, they decrease oxidative stress, and they increase amyloid beta removal. So these are all things from a pathological perspective that might be really, really helpful for treating an illness like Alzheimer's disease. So again, in terms of the theoretic rationale for using cannabinoids in Alzheimer's disease, there's lots of really good rationale. If you're going to prescribe cannabinoids, and I'm not talking now about medical cannabis, and I do not recommend medical cannabis, but if you're going to prescribe pharmaceutical-grade compounds, you have a number of alternatives in Canada. Actually, in Canada, we only have Nabilone and Sativex, or Sesamet and Sativex. Nabilone or Sesamet is actually now genericized, and it's made by a number of the generic drug companies. It is approved by Health Canada for the treatment of chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. And then Sativex, which is the spray, has both THC and cannabidiol, and so it is most like medical cannabis, or most like cannabis. And it is approved for the treatment of neuropathic pain and multiple sclerosis. So we can actually prescribe these synthetic drugs to our patients and be sure of what they are actually getting, as opposed to giving them medical marijuana, where we're never sure exactly what kinds of amounts of THC and CBD that they're going to be getting. So what is the data that cannabinoids have a potential benefit in Alzheimer's disease? And I've published probably two of the only reviews in the literature on it. The most recent was in the spring, the second reference that you see down there. And here is the great body of literature that we have for evidence for using cannabinoids to treat Alzheimer's disease. As you can see, there are very few studies. There are very small numbers of patients in these studies, and many of them are not randomized placebo-controlled trials. We try to meta-analyze the data, even though it's really not good data to meta-analyze. And just the one thing I just want to show you is that these are the THC studies. You can't get more negative data than the THC studies that have been published so far. These are the studies with synthetic cannabinoids. Our study is not included in there, and we would put our line right about here, well into the significant effect area. So there, the evidence, at least that exists now, even though it's very small, is far more supportive of using synthetic cannabinoids than it is of using natural cannabinoids. So these are the three studies. If you go to clinicaltrials.gov, these are the three studies that have been registered on clinicaltrials.gov right now. Again, only three studies, very, very small, very limited data. So let me tell you about our study. This was supported by the Alzheimer's Disease Discovery Foundation, as I mentioned before, and the Alzheimer's Society of Canada. I'm going to skip this slide. And so again, we can talk about the clinical pharmacology of the two synthetic cannabinoids afterwards. So our patients were elderly, moderate to severe Alzheimer's disease, less than 24, and most of them were actually below 10 on the MMSE, as I'll show you in a minute. They had to have significant clinical agitation or aggression, and they had to be stable on their medications, including cholinesterase inhibitors prior to the trial. For better or for worse, we used a what's called a crossover design, where patients were started on placebo. They had a week of placebo run-in. They were randomized to either Nabilone or placebo, and then after 6 weeks, they were crossed actually they were withdrawn from whatever medication they were on, or placebo, and then they were re-randomized to the other medication. There's a lot of advantages and disadvantages to this type of clinical trial design that I won't talk about now. Our major primary outcome measure was agitation using the Cohen-Mansfield Agitation Inventory, and we had a lot of secondary outcomes, including other behavioral measures, cognitive function, global change, safety, as well as experimental outcomes being pain and nutritional status. So our average patients were 87 years of age. Most of them were males, again, because I work at Sunnybrook, which is a Veterans Affairs Canada facility. We did have outpatients as well. About a third of our patients. Oh, here you go. 64% were from the Veterans Affairs Canada facility, and the others were from outpatient clinics. And they all had very significant agitation and aggression as measured by the Cohen-Mansfield Agitation Inventory. Just to give you an idea about the kind of symptoms that they had, all of them obviously had agitation in a significant way. A lot of them were irritable and anxious as well. And then some had some abnormal behavioral movements, apathy and appetite. So a behaviorally disturbed patient population. Average MMSE was 7. They had some pain, and a number of them were considered malnourished based on the MNASF. And a lot of them were on psychotropic medications, as you can see. 83% were on antidepressants. That includes trazodone. About 57% were on antipsychotics. And remember, again, whatever they came in on the study, they had to remain on those psychotropic medications throughout the course of the study, and we didn't make any changes prior to or during the study. This is our primary efficacy results, and I'm going to point out that there was definitely a clear statistically significant separation between placebo and between nabilone, benefiting nabilone. Here are the Here's the clinical global impression differences. Again, so as you can see, the blue being nabilone there was much more in the way of improvements in the nabilone compared to the placebo phase. So this was a statistically significant outcome. Just to give you a flavor of the actual numbers, as you can see, if you look at the total neuropsychiatric inventory scale score, it favored nabilone between 4 and 5 points decline. That is considered mild, but it would be clinically relevant improvement in terms of behaviors. In terms of cognition, here is some of the caveats. In terms of cognition, although our primary safety outcome measure for cognition was the mini mental state examination, and if anything, the mini mental state examination improved more on nabilone than it did on placebo, when we did the severe impairment battery, which is a much more detailed measure of cognitive function, particularly useful for patients with moderate to severe Alzheimer's disease, we did find that patients on nabilone declined cognitively. It wasn't the full sample, and there are certainly difficulties getting patients to do the full SIB when they are in the severe stage of Alzheimer's disease. But we did have a concern that there may be a negative cognitive effect on the patients that we were treating. Similarly, there was more sedation with nabilone, and that was significant. 45% of patients who were treated with the nabilone did become sedated, and that compared to only 16% with placebo. Although none of the patients had to drop out, or there was no statistically significant dropout as a result of excessive sedation when we compared nabilone to placebo. So what does this tell you? So I think I've probably shown you that there is very little clinical trial data supporting the use of cannabinoids, whether it's THC or THC-like medical cannabinoid compounds or synthetic cannabinoids at the moment. There is some emerging data that it might be useful. But my concern is that there is significant, it's clearly significant sedation associated with the use of these compounds. and that there may be a signal for impaired cognition associated with it. So I really do not think that this is ready for daily prime time use. I think this may eventually offer an alternative to things like antipsychotics, which we know have significant adverse events such as mortality and cerebrovascular adverse events. We still need much more data. The other problem, I don't know for those of you who have already been trying, and I know that many of you are already using Nabilone, but for those of you who have been using Nabilone, you probably know that they went through a period of about 6 months where Teva stopped making it for a while, and it was unavailable, and they just started making it in the last month or two again. So it will become more readily available, but we're suffering with drug shortages with this compound, as well as a number of others. Thank you.
Thank you. My next friend, Paul Katz. Good information.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm speaking. Many of you could come up here and give this talk, so I know I'm preaching to the choir. I think the gist of my remarks is to keep what you're doing, expand on your educational role, and for those of you who are not doing it, hopefully the next few minutes will convince you to get involved. So why is the nursing home an ideal site? Wide spectrum of care needs. The nursing home population is heterogeneous. This is a perfect substrate upon which you can demonstrate basic principles of geriatric care. And one notion that I try to get across to learners is, despite the fact that our population is very frail, they have a lot of comorbidity, there's still a great chance to enhance physical and psychological function and to impact, very importantly, quality of life. The fact that many of our residents, as we know, lack social and economic supports, i.e., that's why they're in the nursing facility, they may be in the terminal stages of illness, they need chronic care, that really presents a variety of medical, legal, ethical, and even administrative issues that challenge what you do as a primary care provider. And this is a great educational venue because of that. And also because the care that we provide is usually less technologically dependent, it's more person-centered. We also know that the care we provide is interdisciplinary in nature. So, and we focus on functional independence rather than disease or on diagnostic modalities, a kind of traditional medical model approach that many learners are brought up with. The nursing home is also an ideal place to better understand the linkages within the continuum, particularly between the acute care hospital and long-term care systems, and oftentimes to highlight the inadequate care practices or the inappropriate care practices that we find during those transitions. Nursing homes also offer an advantage as a training site because of the fact that there's usually a less frenetic pace. You can be a little more thorough. You can sit down with the resident, have a robust discussion. Usually not competing at the bedside for patient access or faculty attention as you may do in the hospital. And overall, the space is just more conducive to education. So the benefits of exposing residents, I have to admit that there is not a robust literature or evidence base to say what model works, what type of benefits do we have. There seems to be some very old literature that says there's improved attitudes, knowledge, and skills of learners when you expose them to nursing home resident education. Of course, one of the reasons we'd like to do this as teachers is encourage young physicians, other learners such as nurse practitioners and physician assistants to enter nursing home practice as part of what they do. And as I mentioned, there is some signal that you might get improved outcomes for nursing home residents when the residents are involved longitudinally in the care of their patients. The training requirements and Fred, you'll have to, this slide was prepared a few years ago. I do not think the training requirements changed but you can throw tomatoes at me if they did. The College of Family Physicians of Canada and the analogous American Academy of Family Physicians in the U.S. emphasize longitudinal long-term care experience. But generally, the exposure is modest, and that's going to vary from one program to another. For internists, the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons suggests that you have a geriatric experience, while the American Board of Internal Medicine in the U.S. requires such. But again, usually long-term care exposure is not the focus, and it often tends to be modest. There's not a large literature as to how well we're doing. I usually show this slide, which is, 17 years old now. This was a survey of graduating residents with fewer than 15% noting that they felt very prepared to provide nursing home care. I would hazard to guess that that percentage probably has not changed dramatically over the last couple decades. So what are the prerequisites for optimal training? It's really you guys in the audience. Nothing works unless you have engaged a knowledgeable role model. You have to demonstrate the diversity and challenge of nursing and home care. You are the one to demonstrate the skill necessary to practice effectively in the complicated environment that we practice in. Importantly, you have to counter negative stereotypes. I think when you're teaching in this nursing home setting, you are in essence showing how difficult it is. And you have a very specific skill set that establishes credibility in young learners. It also hopefully will highlight career opportunities. The nursing home, and again, I know I'm stating the obvious, but when you choose the facility that you want to have learners attend, I think you need to realize that you need a nursing home culture that embraces teaching. You need buy-in from the nursing home leadership, the administrator, the director of nursing, as it's called in the U.S. That is critical. If you're not all on the same page, it's not going to be successful. You don't necessarily need to be associated with a university. You don't necessarily need a faculty appointment. Sometimes the leadership in the nursing home administration may find that is useful. They can market themselves. You know, we're a affiliate of University X. We have teachers. That's a good thing. It's a win-win. And you also need systems in place that will accommodate the varying schedules of trainees, particularly if you have trainees that are providing longitudinal care over several months. Who's going to be on call? When they can't get hold of the resident, is a provider, the faculty, are you on call? Those sorts of details have to be worked out. Another prerequisite for optimal training is a nursing home that demonstrates quality. That's a good nursing home that you'd be proud to walk into. You have to have well-functioning interdisciplinary teams because you're going to be exposing them to the trainee, hopefully. You need nursing home residents that are routinely engaged and active. If you bring a learner into a facility that smells of urine and everyone is lined up in the wheelchair, slumped over and drooling, guess what? It doesn't matter how good of a clinician you are and how what you're going to demonstrate at the bedside. The minute that learner walks into the home, they're already turned off. You need a clean and well-ordered environment. And I'm sure there are many other bullet points we could put here, but these are three important ones. I think for optimally, and many family practice residencies are doing these, you need a longitudinal experience, as I was alluding to earlier, that has adequate patient volume. And many would suggest you need at least 1 year to appreciate a natural course of illness. It's even if you go in and see a resident in the nursing home one or two times, you really don't get an appreciation for what's going on, what's going to happen, and what kind of decision-making is important in that particular individual. A longitudinal experience over several months assures you're going to see a diverse number of patients, both acute and chronic problems, and I think that's going to optimize your teaching experience. However, many times you may have a medical student around with you once or twice, so exposure is limited. It's still going to be a good teaching experience. It can be. And there are many ways to do that. I've often found, and I'm sure you have many examples, when you're admitting a new resident from the hospital, to have the learner, the medical student, for example, do that. And now the first thing they often say is, well, where are the records? What am I supposed to do? And your response is, well, welcome to my world. That's a great teaching experience. Having the learner attend team rounds, either with or without you, having them shadow individual disciplines from the therapists to the nurses passing meds, to the social worker doing intake or family counseling can be very helpful. Of course, one-on-one with you, the physician, and the trainee is ideal at the bedside, particularly when you're involved in family meetings, as you know, and exposing them to very intimate discussions such as end-of-life discussions that they may not have the opportunity to see in the hectic hospital environment. I would suggest that if whatever type of learner you have, whether it's the one-time learner or the learner who is going to be with you longitudinally, is you need to give them some training material. I'm labeling this as a nursing home primer. I think much of what we learned here, many of the, in fact, the course that Fred taught on the for the attending physician, that could constitute a nursing home primer for new trainees. So you need a uniform knowledge base that they can refer to that is going to assure some consistent identification of standards of care and competency. And this primer should focus on the issues that we find that we struggle with: systems of care, the regulatory environment, this interface between acute and long-term care, principles of rehabilitation, quality measurement, capacity assessment, care planning, end of life. Those are the things that they're going to need to refer back to. Another obvious prerequisite for optimal training is you have to have some sort of feedback. Now, the feedback can be at the bedside with or without the team. It can be in the form of a formal case presentation. I find that's ideal if you have multiple learners doing that. Could maybe have the learner create a written review of a case history or specific aspects of a disease or a condition or a syndrome that you may have encountered at the bedside. Reflections are also can be very powerful. My last two slides are from a study reported a few years ago in JAMDA where medical students were assigned to write open-ended reflection papers on their experience in this continuing care retirement community, which involved assisted living in nursing homes. And these six themes emerge. These are not, these would be what we expected. Things dealing with death and dying, dementia, the cost of care, kind of act of successful aging, team relationships. And just to end, these are the sort of reflections. These are from medical students. I'm extremely uncomfortable with death and dying. I want to learn to understand the process and how to become comfortable with passing ons. Or my interactions made me think about the fact that I will someday be dependent upon someone else. We will all be dependent if we live long enough. Well, hopefully not, but that's the medical student's reflection. This complex house, such a diverse spectrum of health and fitness, I realized that my attending physician could care for a whole community in many different ways. So continue to do what you're doing. This is in terms of ensuring the future of what we do. We need to all be educators in one form or another. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. I would invite people to come to the mic. We do have some time for questions. I want to remind my friends that this is the third day of a very busy conference, and these guys don't know when to turn their brains off, but they do get tired. So being given such useful information in bursts like that really helps us to cap off a successful conference. Yes, on microphone D.
This is for Dr. Herman. I just wonder why you're so against medical cannabis. You really didn't give good evidence for that. It certainly is a topical thing these days, and like it or not, our patients are going to be using it. Now it's legal. They're going to be using it more, and I think we have to be careful to not vacate that part of medicine, that part of research, part of medicine that is going to become even more important as time goes on. There have been people who, it's a dynamic area right now where a lot of things are being discussed, and there's been some room for medical cannabis in various conditions. So I just wonder why you're against it.
So just like we know that alcohol is legal for use, doesn't mean that physicians are going to prescribe alcohol for their patients, even though it does have some anti-anxiety effects and other possibly positive medical effects. I think that medical cannabis is in that same category. And the reason I believe that we need to be so careful is because there is so little data. When we're talking about the effects of these drugs in patients that are frail and elderly and have dementia, I showed you the literature. There's less than 150 people in the world in the history of medical clinical trials that have been exposed to cannabinoids. I can't reliably make recommendations to people about how to use these medical compounds with that kind of a very poor database. So I certainly am not going to be recommending these drugs until we know more about them. And I think what we do know just from everyday use is that they have a lot of potential problems associated with them. The last thing we want to do is sedate our patients and make them unsteady in their feet and lead to falls. And I think that that is a potential problem associated with these drugs. So the other major problem with medical cannabis is that we're never sure, A, what compounds are getting into the body and how many of those compounds and what concentrations are getting into their body. The delivery systems are varied and problematic. And again, even though you might be 100% sure that your recommended dose of medical cannabis might be safe for an individual patient, you're still not sure how much of that concentration is going to be reaching that person's body and their brain. And I think that's a problem. Maybe Joanne would like to make some comments about that.
I would love to. Thank you. This is actually a very common consult that we get at Jerry Mebrisk. It's in a fair number of them are actually posed by physicians who work in cannabis clinics. I would agree with Dr. Herman that it's hard to fully understand what is actually in that product. And yes, there some licensed producers will present their THC content, their CBD content. Some of them will present what other compounds are in there, and terpenes are very important compounds. Some of them have individual psychotropic effects. Some of them will have drug-drug interactions. And depending on how much is actually getting into the system will have a very large impact on that patient and the other medications and the other medical comorbidities that an individual will have. So just as one small example, if I may, there is one example, there's this one study where there is CBD, so cannabidiol, prepared in an oil prepared by a pharmaceutical company in Germany. So we knew exactly what was in there. And when they administered it to individuals, the plasma concentrations varied by up to 10-fold. So that's actually very interesting because it's hard to know exactly how much your individual patient's receiving. Maybe they're on the lower end of the spectrum. Maybe that's why it doesn't make a difference. Maybe they're at the higher end of that spectrum and they're getting a huge effect. I mean, that's almost like giving maybe 1 milligram of hydromorphone or maybe 10 milligrams of hydromorphone. I mean, there's just a variation. So my big suggestion is, ask for whatever they're taking, ask for that product monograph. Ask the licensed producer to provide you with that product monograph so you know exactly how much THC, CBD, and which terpenes are in there, whether it be myrcene, beta-caryophyllene. Ask for that. And then from there, then we can work and figure out this is going to interact with your amiodarone, this is going to interact with your phenytoin, your clobazam, and your valproic acid. And this might potentially induce an adverse cardiac event, and it may also precipitate heart failure depending on what that patient has. So I appreciate that it's out there, it's being used, and there could be some, you know, it's out there, but it's helpful if we can understand what it is first, and then we go from there for that particular individual patient.
Okay, the back there by the post, are you going to ask a question?
No,
Okay, so Lorraine.
Thank you again for the panel. My question is for Dr. Ho and Dr. Katz. The long-term care world is somewhat different in Canada than in the United States. And I'm specifically discussing about presence of geriatricians in this long-term care milieu and the fact that in the U.S., geriatrics seems to be a primary care specialty, at least to some degree, with much heavier involvement of geriatricians in the daily clinical practice in long-term care. So I was wondering if you could comment on, you know, the Canadian environment, how could this potentially be changed, and also on the fact of the presence of lack of presence of teaching long-term care homes in Canada.
So it's true that we have a dearth of geriatricians in the U.S. as you do in Canada, and many geriatricians do go into long-term care, and many of them will provide primary care. The question is, personally, I find that having that longitudinal experience, providing primary care, whether you're a geriatrician or a family physician or an internist in the U.S., really provides a context for the learner that is a little broader. You can certainly do it as a consultant, no question about that. But I find that you almost need to be a primary care, providing primary care to give a really the best sense of what's going on and what's going to happen and prognosticating, et cetera. I don't think I'm answering your question. We need more of everyone. We need more geriatricians. We need more physicians, whether they be family physicians or interns that are committed to nursing home care. One of the things we're trying to do that I've been very involved with is to try to get a specialty designated, a nursing home specialty, much like hospitalists are specialized in the U.S., and then prove that those who specialize and have this this unique competency and skill set actually deliver better care. And if we can make those connections, we can get policy changed, hopefully, which will hopefully enhance reimbursement, attract more physicians into the field, et cetera. That's my 10-year plan.
Joanne, we'll give the final word to you.
Oh, fine. Okay. Better say something helpful then. So I know of some geriatricians and geriatric psychiatrists that are connected and linked to long-term care homes. And I think that's one particular model of care. And sometimes they have an actual schedule that once a month they're going to come in. Where we are, it can be very hard to actually get to the long-term care home. Fortunately, we also have good colleagues like all of us here, where you guys know your team, you know your patients very well. And that's one of the reasons why Jerry Membris was actually born pretty much in Waterloo Region. It was really because it's hard to get there, but is there a way we can use technology so that we can still support each other? And so that's really where it came from, so that even in the middle, in between those month visits, there's a way that you can still have support from, you know, geriatric psychiatry, geriatric medicine, geriatric pharmacy, and clinical pharmacology. So thanks.
I want to thank the people on the panel, and I look forward to when we can get together again and carry on the conversation. Thank you.